Our guest today is Ian Mays. He is a Howard Hughes Medical Institute investigator and professor of neuroscience and pharmacological science at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. His research involves studying the chromatin-based mechanisms of adult cognitive and psychiatric disorders like addiction and major depression, in particular, how monoamines like serotonin and dopamine can act as epigenetic regulators to influence gene expression and the implications in disease and treatment. What is epigenetics and what do you think is the most beautiful thing about it?
So epigenetics, I think historically has been used to describe a process through which you can achieve changes in gene expression in the absence of changes to the DNA content itself. And so I think that, again, from a more historical perspective, we tend to think about these things as things that we experience in our lifetime being able to be transmitted to subsequent generations through germ cells. I think, however, epigenetics now is used a little more loosely to describe any process through which gene expression, specific patterns of gene expression, can be achieved without changing the DNA sequence itself. And I think that the beautiful thing about epigenetics is that it allows this incredibly fine-tuned system through which even very similar cell types can achieve very different functional outputs or phenotypes simply through the regulation of these chemical processes that allow for certain genes to be on and off at a given time and within specific cells in certain scenarios.
So each cell has the same genetic sequence, but different epigenetic regulations?
That's correct. So, you know, if you look at, you know, your own DNA sequence, right, every single cell within your body is going to be the same, basically, in terms of its DNA content. You're going to be having 50% from your mother, 50% from your father. However, neurons do not look like cardiac myocytes, do not look like adipocytes, do not look like other cells in the body. Even within the brain, even similar neuronal subtypes do not look the same oftentimes from a phenotypic standpoint. And so the way that this is achieved is by allowing that DNA to breathe, if you will, to be expressed or to be shut down under very specific situations to allow cell type identities to arise and then ultimately certain phenotypes of those cells to come to fruition.
Maybe if you could give us like a quick epigenetics 101. So what are some of the physical mechanisms that you can use to change the expression of genes?
Sure. So our DNA, our double-stranded DNA, is of course wrapped tightly around these proteins that we refer to as histone proteins. These are basically DNA packaging proteins that are highly charged that help to condense the DNA or the chromatin into the nucleus of cells. And what's very interesting about these proteins, these histone proteins, is that they have these regions that protrude outside of the main region that's bound to DNA that we call tails. And these are unstructured regions of the protein that are actually very amenable to chemical modifications, post-translational modifications, things like phosphorylation, acetylation, methylation, and so on. And so the combination of these different types of modifications on these histone proteins can act to regulate accessibility of the certain proteins like transcription factors that regulate gene expression. And they do this either through changing the electrostatic properties of those histones so that they can either repel, the histones can be repelled from the DNA or can more tightly bound, or they can recruit accessory proteins that then in turn can help to achieve certain gene expression states. So that's one major mechanism. And then of course the DNA itself can be chemically modified itself. For example, it can be methylated or hydroxymethylated. And of course there's a slew of other modes through which this can be achieved. You can change the activity or expression of transcription factors, which are the actual DNA binding proteins that drive gene expression. You can express in different ways long and small non-coding RNAs. These all play into some of these transcriptional and post-transcriptional processes. So it's a very complicated web of mechanisms that allow for this to be finely tuned. But I guess it goes back to your original question about the beauty of this process. It all seems to work together, and that's really amazing.
So like with the histone regulation. So the idea is that if you make the DNA looser, then you make the DNA, you let the DNA becomes much more accessible to allow gene transcription, and that allows the expression of genes in that specific area.
Yeah, I think maybe a slight oversimplification, but I think it's a good way to think that, you know, if you loosen that grip on the DNA, that you open it up so that the DNA binding proteins can come in, bind, and then, you know, promote their function. Although do keep in mind that under certain circumstances, DNA can be made accessible, and then repressive factors can also bind to those regions, thereby stabilizing kind of the shutoff valve for those specific genes. But yeah, the general idea is that at the end of the day, all of these chromatin mechanisms that we'll probably talk about today, their ultimate goal is to regulate accessibility of the DNA so that the transcription factors themselves can bind and then promote or inhibit transcription.
If I could ask a bit further.
Sure.
How does the epigenetic regulation get regulated?
How does the epigenetic? Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. So, I mean, a lot of the proteins that regulate either the establishment or removal of post-translational modifications on DNA or on histone proteins, they themselves are also prone to regulation. So they can be chemically modified, for example, that can change what things they bind to. It can change how well they can associate with those chromatin factors. So that's one way. Of course, there is epigenetic regulation of epigenetic regulators. So for example, we see that in a lot of neurodevelopmental disorders like autism spectrum disorders and perhaps others like schizophrenia, that there are kind of changes early on or mutational patterns that are seen that therefore disrupt the chromatin regulators themselves. And that in turn will disrupt the epigenetic landscape. And that then leads to some of these disease states. So, but yeah, it's definitely, it's not a linear mechanism. It's definitely all a feed forward or feedback loop.
And can these epigenetic regulations be passed down generations the same way that genetics is passed down?
I think this is the million-dollar question in the field. And I think that it's still relatively unclear. I think, you know, obviously biology has tended away from kind of Lamarckian theory about the, you know, the ability to pass down acquired characteristics. So I don't think that it certainly works in that way. I think there is some evidence that suggests that things that we do during our lifetime can affect our germ cells, and that in turn can lead to perhaps changes in the offspring. You know, there's been some interesting studies that suggest that males on high fat diets, for example, can pass down a transcriptional profile that leads to inappropriate metabolism. There's been some studies that suggest that stress and chronic drug abuse can also lead to behavioral changes later on in the offspring lineage. However, the mechanisms that are allowing that to happen, I think, have not been well defined. So I would, that's why I say I think that the word epigenetics tends to carry with it this weight of having to be passed from generation to generation. And I'm not sure that that's necessarily appropriate, depending on the way that we look at these different mechanisms.
Oh, but am I right in thinking that epigenetic regulations can be modulated by experiences and the environment?
Yes, absolutely. So, I mean, you know, as we sit here and we talk right now, right? I mean, there are your neurons are firing, you're making new connections, you're losing and pruning other connections. And all of this is going to fundamentally change the transcriptional patterning within the specific neural ensembles that are allowing this type of engagement. And so, of course, everything that we experience in our life, good, bad, or indifferent, these things will ultimately change these epigenetic processes. Now, whether or not that can then be passed on to our offspring, I think that's the more challenging question.
So like on a daily basis, like why would you need dynamic changes in gene expression if, you know, you've already established a cell identity, like, so the cell only has to do what it's meant to do. So why does it have to be modulated by experience?
Well, so I think that obviously when you talk about, you know, like you mentioned, establishing cell identity, this is a major change that has to occur early in development, right? Where you need to be able to say, you are this type of cell and you need to stay that way. However, you know, particularly when you think of the nervous system, plasticity is incredibly important, right? Neurons are post-mitotic. They cannot regenerate for the most part. There are some neurons that perhaps can undergo neurogenesis. But for the most part, you have post-mitotic non-dividing cells that need to be very responsive to changes in your environment. So when you learn something new or you experience something negative, you need to be able to adapt to that. You need to change the way that synapses function or form. You sometimes need to prune those processes away. And so you need a mechanism that allows the cell to know when it has to change and adapt. And I think that, you know, this is a key with a lot of our research is that oftentimes upon repeated insults of different things, and we can get more into it as we go on, you know, these types of systems can start to break down. And as they break down, then you can't respond appropriately. And then sometimes you end up in aberrant or disease-like states.
What sort of insults are you talking about?
Sure. So, I mean, so I can give two very brief examples of things we study in my lab. So we study both substance use disorder and also chronic stress and major depressive disorder. So these are, I think, examples where, you know, a lot of people, for example, throughout the world will engage in some kind of substance use throughout their life. Sometimes only once, sometimes they may use it frequently. Sometimes people become compulsive users. And so one of the questions we've always had is that what helps to kind of promote that type of transition? So for example, there are some people that can, you know, abuse drugs, but never become, we would consider, addicted. And then there are other people that may not take drugs as much and they become addicted. And so the question for us is, are there changes, for example, in these epigenetic processes that allow the neurons how to respond to those types of insults that somehow break down or get reinforced inappropriately that then allow basically these circuits to establish this kind of repetitive or habit-like types of behavior. And I think that we have seen, and of course many others have found, that chronic drug use can start to change epigenetic processes, and these changes can persist throughout perhaps the lifetime of that animal. And so that's really kind of a, you know, it may be an extreme example. The other is, of course, stress adaptation, sorry, where basically, you know, we experience stressors in our life every day, but and some level of stress is, of course, good. You know, being resilient to certain stressors is partially what makes us human. But on the other hand, if you experience chronic exposures to stress over time, you will start to break down those behavioral processes. And we believe that some of this is dictated starting the level of epigenetics and transcription, then leading to changes in circuit formation, and then ultimately leading to those maladaptive behaviors.
What is a maladaptive change in epigenetics compared to a normal, healthy physiological change?
I would say any change that reinforces a so-called negative phenotype. So for the example of something like cancer, right, that could be shutting off the cell cycle controls that basically prevent cells from proliferating out of control, right? So if you have some kind of epigenetic process that occurs that now leads to these genes being turned off that normally need to be there to tell the cells to stop proliferating, I would consider that obviously a maladaptive epigenetic change. Now, in the context of neural physiology, it gets a little more complicated, but going back to the drug addiction example, you know, let's say that in response to positive things in your life, dopaminergic neurons need to release dopamine to kind of help reinforce whatever that behavior is, right? So if you taste something good versus something that maybe tastes bad, you want to be able to know that and be able to predict that moving forward. So the dopamine system is very important for gauging natural reward. However, if you take drugs chronically, cocaine, heroin, whatever it may be, and all of a sudden your brain starts to switch itself to think, you know what, we don't care about natural rewards, but what we want is we want drug rewards. You can reinforce those types of behaviors, and it's thought that those behaviors are reinforced at the level of circuitry. Well, something, some underlying mechanism has to change, right, to allow those circuitry differences. And so we think the transcriptional plasticity or aberrant plasticity and aberrant epigenetic mechanisms may be responsible.
And what is the time scale of these epigenetic changes? So are they hours or is it across years?
I think it's really dependent on the specific experience. So we know, for example, that in neurons, if you just depolarize them, so let's say you culture neurons, primary neurons in a dish, and you add potassium chloride, it will turn the neurons on, so they start to fire. We know that within a minute or less, that certain chromatin modifications will come on, they'll be marking specific genes, and they are helping to control the recruitment of proteins to regulate whether genes turn on or turn off in response to that relatively robust stimulus. Presumably, these types of things also happen in the brain. You know, as we talk, there's probably modifications coming on and coming off that are helping to establish this transcriptional profile. Having said that, whether or not those things persist, I think, is a bigger question. And again, going back to some of our behavioral examples, we have seen that even when you remove these negative stimuli, like drugs of abuse, chronic stress, et cetera, that some of these changes that occurred during those processes can actually last for very extended periods of time. We have a study in our lab that's very fascinating, looking at the effect of pregnancy, for example, on epigenetic regulation in the female brain, even at periods well after, right, the pregnancy experience. And we see that some of these epigenetic regulatory mechanisms that start to occur during those periods or during postpartum periods can last even a year after an animal has not been pregnant. So it suggests that there is something that can last for a very extended period of time. But it really is dependent on the stimulus and the experience.
So some epigenetic changes can be very short and very dynamic, while others will persist over long periods of time.
That's right. And so just as one quick example, you know, phosphorylation of histones is something that comes on very quickly in response to many different stimuli. So not just in neurons with depolarization, but in macrophages with LPS stimulation and so on and so forth. And so they come on and they come off very quickly. But again, there are many that can last seemingly for a very long period of time.
Okay, let's go into serotonin and dopamine. So for those unfamiliar with this, could you briefly talk about what are serotonin and dopamine, and classically, what are they associated with?
Sure. So serotonin and dopamine are what we call linear hydrophobic monoamine molecules. Okay. So that probably doesn't mean a lot to most people, but basically they are chemicals that are produced within the body, to some degree produced within the brain in very specific regions of the brain, and also within the periphery. So for example, our largest pool of serotonin is produced within the gastrointestinal tract. But from a neuroscience perspective, we tend to think about these as signaling molecules. So I think the classical way we think about monoamine neurotransmitters, quote unquote, is that they act to help neurons communicate during different periods of stimulation. So if you have a serotonergic neuron that is communicating, let's say, with a glutamatergic neuron in the cortex, in response to a stimulus, serotonin will be released from that serotonergic neuron, will bind to receptors on the postsynaptic neuron, and this will lead to signaling changes within that cell to kind of help establish new circuits and mediate plasticity. And so dopamine would obviously be thought of to do something similar. I think in the, you know, in pop culture, you tend to see these things reduced down to being rewarding molecules. There certainly is evidence that they're involved in reward gating, but I don't think that that's their only function. I will say though that it's important to keep in mind, particularly for neuroscientists out there, that serotonin and dopamine are not only involved in neurotransmission, right? So they also are, as I mentioned, are very heavily produced within the periphery. So they're found in the gastrointestinal tract, they're found in circulating blood, they're taken up by platelets, and they do seem to serve what we call trophic functions, so kind of non-monoaminergic neurotransmission functions throughout many different tissues in cellular systems. And so they have a wide array of functions. And also things like serotonin are very evolutionarily conserved, right? So you see these things all the way down to much lower organisms. They're produced in some, or they're stimulated in terms of their production by microbiota. So they're very important for many different things. But again, as neuroscientists, we classically think of them as chemical neurotransmitters.
So they have very different functions depending on where they're produced.
This is very true. Yeah. So, I mean, they're produced, for example, in the gastrointestinal tract in enterochromaffin cells, but then they're released into the blood and they can help mediate, for example, in the pancreas, insulin release, right? Now, why they do that, I think, is still unclear, but we know that it's involved in that process. It's involved in gastrointestinal motility. We know that during early embryonic development, they're involved in things like digit patterning. Right? We know that non-brain contributed serotonin, so serotonin coming from the placenta during pregnancy in the embryo, is controlling cortical migration patterns, right? So they do something very different depending not only on what tissues they're being expressed in or circulated in, but also at what time during development.
And the specific effect is determined by the receptor that they bind to.
So this has been the kind of the canonical way of thinking about it, is that serotonin will bind to its receptors, which are broadly expressed, or transporters, which can help bring them into certain cells. And then that is how they achieve their biological function. And I think that's, as we'll talk about, that's what kind of separates some of the work that we're doing.
Okay, so what is serotonylation?
Yeah, so serotonylation is the idea that a serotonin molecule can serve as a chemical donor for a novel class of modification, chemical modification or covalent modification to substrate proteins, meaning that the serotonin molecule itself can form bonds, right? So sharing electron pairs with proteins of interest at very specific amino acids. So there you have glutamine residues on proteins that are basically forming covalent bonds with the serotonin itself. And so this is very different than binding to a receptor and being able to be released. This is really actually covalently attaching itself to another protein to regulate that protein's function.
Mm. Right. And how did we discover this? Was this a surprising discovery?
Yeah, so it, in all transparency, so you know, we were not the lab that discovered serotonin elation. There was actually a literature dating back to the 1950s. This is more of a chemical literature that suggested that certain proteins, such as the transglutaminase family, could actually incorporate amines into certain protein substrates. Now, at the time, nobody really knew what this was doing, but you know, they suggested that at least that it could happen. It wasn't until the early 2000s that Michael Bader's group at the Max Delbruck in Berlin actually showed that this process, at least in theory, could occur. Now, why I say in theory is that in those original studies, it was all performed in situ. So they were taking, you know, radioactive serotonin, for example, mixing it in a tube with protein lysates from platelets, which don't produce serotonin themselves, and then adding this recombinant or transglutaminase protein they made in vitro. And when they do that, they were able to see that it looked like some proteins, their favorite GTPases, for example, were able to be serotonylated. And so it wasn't then until I think we started getting into the game where we wanted to ask the question, okay, it looks like these things can happen. Do they really happen? On which proteins do you see these modifications? And then ultimately, what is the functional impact of these modifications?
Mm. Right. And like in, so we talked about serotonin being used as a neurotransmitter in the brain. It binds to receptors on neurons. So, but if we're talking about serotonylation, then where does the serotonin come from and how does it get into the nucleus?
Yeah, it's a great question. So in terms of where the serotonin comes from, so, you know, within the brain, the serotonin that is produced is the serotonin content of the brain. So basically all serotonin produced in the periphery, this serotonin pool does not make it into the brain, does not pass the blood-brain barrier, at least pass during late stages of embryogenesis. And the dorsal raphe nucleus within the brain is the serotonergic nucleus. So you got to keep in mind that this particular region of the brain, the dorsal raphe nucleus, projects broadly throughout the brain, almost to every single region of the brain, cerebellum, cortex, striatum, and so on. And so we think that the brain pool where we see this in the nervous system is coming obviously from the dorsal raphe. Now, in terms of how it gets into the nucleus, this is a much more complicated question. I will say that, you know, our original expectation was that it was just passively moving between the cytoplasm and the nucleus. I now believe this is not true. It's not published yet, so I can't tell you what it is, but we do believe that there is a nuclear transporter that is actually helping to both bring it in and remove it from the nucleus within those cells. And we believe that this transporter, which is expressed on the nuclear membrane, is also expressed on non-serotonergic neurons. And that may also in turn help it get into cells that are not producing serotonin on their own.
Mm. A lot of molecular biology is just believing that something was passively transported and then realizing that it's
specific. I feel like akin to this is in the epigenetics field, you know, every time a new modification is identified, the immediate response is, I bet it cannot be removed. And of course, it always can be removed.
Okay, so serotonin can be covalently added to some proteins. So
yeah,
who cares?
Well, I think that it's, you know, it's a great question. So, you know, obviously we're not trying to dispel a literature that has been in existence for the last 75 years. Obviously, roles for serotonin, its canonical roles for neurotransmission are incredibly important. This is not to take away from any of that work. But I think that it's important, and the kind of big who cares question is, well, what about if we've been missing the other side of the coin, right? So if serotonin has existed, for example, I'll give you an evolutionary perspective. Serotonin has existed from an evolutionary perspective long before we had central nervous systems, right? It existed at a time in which the kind of canonical role we think about serotonin as a neurotransmitter really wouldn't have made sense. So from that perspective, what else could it be doing? What is that trophic role? And maybe the actual process of serotonylation was very important for protein function, even when we didn't have central nervous systems. That's one. The other is that what about if this new mode of serotonylation happens much more broadly? So, you know, we study histone proteins in my lab, but we also have kind of expanded upon this work to show that hundreds, if not thousands, of other proteins can be serotonylated. Well, just like modifications like phosphorylation, acetylation, methylation, which we know have very clear roles in regulating how proteins interact, how proteins move from different cellular compartments and so forth, it does seem that serotonylation is also having this much of an impact. And so I think, you know, from just a classical molecular biology standpoint, it's really critical for us to figure out, you know, what is this other side of the coin doing? And is it as functionally important, or at least is it functionally important in the context of neuronal plasticity? And so just to give you one very, very brief example. So let's talk about major depressive disorder and antidepressants, right? So people with major depressive disorder are often prescribed pharmacotherapeutics that regulate serotonin signaling in one way or another. So the classical drugs are things like selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, right? So the idea being that you're maybe not producing enough serotonin or releasing enough serotonin when you're depressed. And therefore, if you block the transporter, you can push too much serotonin into the synapse, and therefore you can renormalize that imbalance, right? And there were even commercials, very nice Zoloft commercials in the, the late 90s or early 2000s that showed that, you know, you give the drug, it alleviates the serotonin imbalance and boom, you're ready to go. Now, the problem with this theory, this serotonin hypothesis of depression, is that actually when you give antidepressants, if this was true, people would immediately display symptomatic alleviation. They'd immediately get better because you've solved the problem. And actually, it turns out that not only do only about 50% of people respond to antidepressants in a positive way, but it takes weeks to months for these things to start taking effect. So I think clearly what this says is that serotonin is involved somehow in this process, but maybe not through its canonical role as a neurotransmitter. And we have data in the lab that we'll publish soon that suggests that actually when you give antidepressants like that, while you can renormalize the serotonin imbalance issue, it takes weeks to months to normalize the aberrant serotonin release signals coming from the dorsal raphe nucleus. And so we think that perhaps it's controlling some of this delayed effect of the drugs. And so I know that's a big long anecdote there, but you know, the basic idea is that maybe by only looking at it in one very myopic way, you're missing the other side of the coin, which could be actually dictating a lot of its functions.
Before I get to the depression bit, I wanted to ask, you said thousands of proteins could be serotonin-related?
Yeah, so we have, in our lab and with collaborators, developed different types of probe approaches that allow us to basically, from different cellular or tissue extracts, pull out proteins that are being serotoninylated or dopaminylated. And for all of these different modifications, it turns out that there are, you know, likely thousands of substrates throughout the brain and certainly more throughout the periphery that can be modified in this way. And so, you know, obviously it's a gargantuan task to try to identify and then mechanistically characterize all of them. But hopefully we'll start publishing these lists and then people can pick off bits and pieces that they want to follow up on.
Right. Well, so there are probably very widespread effects of that serotonin can have in the cell.
Absolutely.
And the idea with the depression is that even though the SSRIs can renormalize the amount of serotonin in the synapse very quickly, it takes time to renormalize the effect of serotonin inside the cell on the epigenetic changes and all of that.
That's right. Exactly.
Okay, so we talked about like serotoninylation what does that have to do with the epigenetics? Does serotonin get attached to like proteins involved in epigenetics?
Yeah, so you know that's actually how we originally got involved in studying these processes. So you know, I was really fascinated by the idea that you know you could have proteins at least theoretically become serotoninylated. There was another body of literature that I won't go into detail on that had showed that serotonin could exist within the nucleus. And actually some work dating back to Ann Young and Candace Pert and Saul Snyder's group from the early 1970s suggesting that things like histamine are almost exclusively nuclear throughout late embryogenesis and early postnatal development in the brain. And so from there, we actually started trying to look specifically at nuclear proteins that could be modified in this way. And of course, not surprisingly, we found that, again, there are at least hundreds of nuclear proteins that can be modified in this way. Many of them are chromatin interacting or regulatory proteins. But the one that really jumped out to us, potentially because of my background as a histomodification researcher, is that we found that histone H3, so one of those core histone proteins that wraps around our DNA, that histone H3, but not the other histone proteins, so H4, H2A, and H2B, only H3 seemed to be able to be modified by serotonin, and it seemed to occur predominantly at one specific glutamine residue in that far kind of unstructured or accessible region of the H3 tail.
So the serotonin is only always added at the same amino acid of the histone tail.
Yeah, so we have some evidence, and so do our collaborators, that there may be another site, so keep an eye out for that in the literature, but it seems that at least one of the dominant sites is this glutamine 5, which happens to sit in a region that's really important for histone H3 function. So that far unstructured N-terminal region of H3 can be heavily clinically modified, and it's really important for recruiting the proteins, such as the general transcription factor machinery RNA polymerase and so forth to allow for transcriptional initiation. And so actually our work and some of our published work, we've shown that by having that serotonylation modification at that glutamine, that you are basically both promoting the recruitment of things that bind to that N-terminal region and also kicking off certain things that are inhibitory to gene expression.
So how does adding a serotonin to that that particular amino acid residue change the properties of the histone?
Sure. So it happens in basically, as far as we know at this point, it happens in one of two ways. So the site at which the glutamine is modified, as I mentioned, is glutamine 5. So it's in the far N-terminal region. Right next door to it is a very important lysine residue on H3, lysine 4, which can be both acetylated and also methylated. So it can have one or two or three methyl groups attached to it. The literature about H3 lysine 4, H3K4 methylation is incredibly robust. There's a lot of literature that suggests that by having that methylated lysine 4, this is what helps to basically bridge the general transcription factor machinery, which is needs to come to eukaryotic chromatin to start gene expression, and RNA polymerase, which needs to bind to those factors in order to come and actually engage with the DNA itself. And so what we have found is that by having both that lysine 4 methylation and the glutamine 5 serotonylation together in combination, that the serotonylation helps to support the function or activities of that lysine methylation. It helps to increase the binding of certain factors, for example, the general transcription factor complex TF2D. It helps to increase the binding to lysine 4. It also inhibits the ability of the enzymes that like to come along and take off lysine 4 methylation. So it basically is increasing the recruitment of certain factors that are needed to start transcription and blocking those demethylases that would then turn off gene expression by removing lysine 4. And so that's kind of one major mechanism that we've been studying. We've published on that to some degree. We also now know, and we'll be publishing on this soon, that in the absence of lysine 4 methylation, glutamine 5 serotonylation can also exist, but it actually seems to recruit a very different subset of what we call reader proteins, the proteins that recognize histones and their modifications, and that a lot of these different factors are actually repressive in nature. And so we have some hypotheses that this kind of switch between this combinatorial state with lysine 4 and the single state may be helping to control the dynamics of gene expression within specific gene loci. Mm.
Do you have intuition for which H3 proteins would be serotonylated? So does serotonin get added onto every H3 protein?
So I don't think so. So when we talk about histone modifications, we talk about that we use the word stoichiometry, right? So the amount of that modification in comparison, for example, to the entire pool. We think the stoichiometry of H3Q5 serotonylation is actually lower than H3K4 trimethyl. And H3K4 trimethyl is not in existence on every H3 protein. In fact, the mass spectrometry data suggests that H3K4 trimethyl only exists on about 0.5% of all of the H3 proteins in existence. So it kind of makes sense, right? The majority, you know, your entire genome, which is a huge genome, is covered in histone proteins. However, the amount of your genome that's actually permissive to transcription is very, very small. I mean, typically within a given cell, you know, less than 1%, right? So it makes sense that lysine 4 will show very specific pockets of enrichment. And we see that Q5 serotonyl tends to overlap strongly with those regions that are normally K4 trimethylated, and it can also exist on some nuclei or nucleosomes that don't have lysine 4, but it's not on every histone.
Did you say 0.5%?
0.5% of the entire histone H3 pool has lysine 4 methylation.
Okay. And within the 0.5, is it random or is it specific?
It's not random, no. So there are very specific loci throughout the genome. So they're going to, you know, for example, if you look at a neuron, right, you need to be able to shut off all the genes that normally would encode, you know, cardiac genes and, you know, whatever it may be, you know, skin genes, et cetera. And so you need to be able to shut off those genes. Those will not be marked by lysine 4 methylation, but you also have to have the genes that will be on within those cells, things that are important for neuronal specific function, things are involved in general metabolism, and there you will see these modifications marked. However, if you move from one cell to another, right, the genes that are marked by these particular modifications will be different, right? So, you know, if you move to a cardiac myocyte, all those neuronal genes where you typically saw these marks in neurons they will not show that enrichment pattern in the other cell type. So it is cell type specific.
Mm-hmm.
And regional specific within the brain, for example. We see different levels of these marks depending on which types of brain cells you're in.
Mm. So serotonylation occurs in every neuron, but the pattern of where it gets, of which H3 proteins it gets attached to, depends on the cell type.
Yeah, so I mean, it definitely depends on the cell type. I would be cautious to say it exists in every neuron. We have not really been able to look at every single cell. We'd love to be able to do single cell, you know, chip seq or maybe cut and tag seq in order to see, you know, really where it is within the different neuronal pool. But we do know that in general, it's, we find it broadly throughout the body. It is enriched in the brain, enriched in the colon, but I don't want to say that it's necessarily in every single cell.
Okay. You mentioned like the 0.5%. Is that, how does that compare to other mechanisms of regulating epigenetics? Is that a lot or is that?
You know, it really depends. So, you know, if you look at a little further down the histone tail at H3 lysine 9, there's a lysine 9 trimethyl modification. This is found at heterochromatic regions of the genome. So these are parts of the genome that are completely silenced. And it's found at repetitive elements. Well, a majority of our genome is silenced and repetitive. So if you look at the stoichiometry of lysine 9 methylation, it's much, much higher, right? Because there's much more of the genome that needs to be silenced at any given time. In terms of other modifications, it's hard to say. You know, if you look at phosphorylation in a non-activated state, you may see none. In an activated state, you may see 5%, right? So it really, really varies. And always keep in mind that it's not just about the overall amount, but it's about what it's in existence with, what is it in combination with? And that's really what's controlling these unique transcriptional states.
Mm. Okay. So this is what occurs in a healthy brain. And in depressed patients, you mentioned that SSRIs may be working by changing, restoring the healthy epigenetic state. So do you see depression as a maladaptive change in epigenetic regulation?
I mean, to some degree. Always keep in mind that, you know, there is, of course, a heritable, purely genetic component to major depressive disorder. It has been very difficult to tease apart, even from a genomic standpoint. You know, there's been a lot of GWAS studies. I think they're getting closer, for example, to finding more of a, you know, which genes are involved in that process. I will say that I think that, you know, there are different types of depression. There are kind of like inborn clinical depression where, you know, there's no seemingly obvious reason why depression is occurring. That could be genetic. However, there are lots of examples where different types of adverse experiences can lead to major depressive disorder. So for example, early life abuse and neglect can often lead to major depressive disorder later in life. You know, you can see that periods, you know, people that go to war and spend time in war zones can come back and were not depressed before, but now are. And so I think that the kind of underlying theme there is that chronic stress can lead to major depressive disorder. It can be at least one precipitating factor. And so what I would like to say about our work is that our work is focused on the stress-induced depression angle, as opposed to the kind of heritable a major depressive disorder itself. But I would say that yes, stress itself, you know, a little bit of stress is not a bad thing. It actually can be good. It can promote resilient behavior, but a lot of stress can really break down those systems. And I think at that level, it is kind of a, at least in part, an epigenetically mediated disease.
Mm. There's more recent theories about depression is that it's a maladaptive change in neuronal plasticity and changes in maladaptive changes in information processing.
Sure.
How does that reconcile with your idea of depression as an epigenetic change?
Well, so keep in mind, I don't want to be overly myopic on histone serotonylation. I mean, we have other studies in the lab, for example, where we've profiled regions of the brain that are very much involved in information processing, subjective valuation of reward, things like the orbital frontal cortex, for example. And we do see that there are very cell type specific changes now using things like cell population specific transcriptional profiling or single cell sequencing, where it does appear that there are changes that occur within these very important information processing brain regions that are happening, for example, specifically within glial populations, and that these particular changes are happening at the epigenetic level or transcriptional level, and then that seems to be very important for the phenotypes that we see. So I think that, you know, there are a lot of ideas, and, you know, particularly in the psychological literature about, you know, what is depression, right? Because, you know, is it just a defect, you know, in information processing? Is it a defect in the ability that we perceive reward? Is it something else? And I think that, you know, this will be debated clinically for a long time, probably. I mean, as you probably know, you know, a psychiatrist can have three people come into their office. They can diagnose all three of them with depression, and none of them have overlapping symptoms, right? So part of the problem is we have difficulties in terms of defining what depression is. But I do think that in terms of underlying susceptibility, particularly in the context of stress, you know, these are things that we can study relatively easily within a laboratory setting. But I think all of these will likely involve some kind of change in transcriptional regulation or plasticity, or have some underlying deficit in those processes that may contribute.
Hmm. Okay, so we talked a lot about serotonin elation. So what about dopamine elation? Does it have similar physiological significance?
You know, so what we've been finding is that, you know, so again, you know, we've identified and published that histones and other proteins now can be serotoninylated, dopaminylated. We have a publication soon to be submitted looking at histamine elation, which is, of course, a little different. Norepinephrine can also be added. Interestingly, we found that GABA and glutamate, which also have similar chemical properties, not overlapping, but similar identical properties, they cannot be transaminated to proteins. But what we found is that the addition of these different monoamines, while there are some similarities in terms of the things on chromatin, for example, that they can recruit to DNA, we have found there are differences. So for example, if you look at serotoninylation versus histamine elation is going to be quite different, because histamine actually has a charge, right? It carries a positive charge, whereas serotonin does not. And because of that, we found that just that slight charge difference completely changes the types of proteins that can interact with serotoninylation versus histaminylation. So it does seem to have important phenotypic differences. But there are, as I mentioned, some similarities. We have seen that multiple of these different types of modifications seem to be important for regulating circuit function and behavior. We have studied, as I mentioned, you know, dopamine elation in the context of substance use disorder, although we are now interested in looking at it in the context of major depressive disorder. We know that dopamine dynamics are also disrupted in stress-related syndromes. We've looked at histamine elation in the context of diurnal cycling or circadian rhythmicity, where we see a lot of interesting changes. And also, I should point out that these marks, while they're relatively broadly distributed throughout the brain and the body, they do show some differential enrichment patterns. So for example, there's a lot of histamine elation within the tuberomammillary nucleus of the hypothalamus, which is the region that produces histamine, right? You see less of it throughout other brain regions. You see a lot of dopamine elation in regions that either produce or receive direct projections from dopaminergic neurons, but not necessarily in other regions. So there are some similarities and some differences in that respect.
Okay, so in mental disorders like addiction or depression, is there a way to tell whether these epigenetic changes are the initial cause of the disorder or something that happens downstream?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is the ultimate challenge, right? And part of the challenge there is that, you know, these diseases and disorders are inherently human disorders, right? You know, major depressive disorder does not really occur in rodent models, for example. There may be some variation of this in non-human primate models, but it's not going to be exactly the same. So we do our best. We tend to try to minimize these types of complex disorders to study very specific phenotypes that are associated with those disorders. So for example, in the context of major depressive disorder in rodents, we can study things like affect, you know, so how they respond to pleasurable versus negative stimuli. We can look at, you know, how they like to socially interact with other animals in response to stress. We can look at how stress affects cognitive abilities and, again, some of that information processing. But again, no model is exactly the same. Having said that, in our models, we can certainly do tests of causality, right? So we have grown in our ability to be able to manipulate these modifications in very specific ways, very specific cell types and time windows. But in terms of the human syndrome, I think it's always hard because, you know, when we study human brains, we study them in a post-mortem context, right? So this is somebody we have some limited case history on. We can see, is there a molecular difference between them and a control? But obviously, you know, humans are very heterogeneous in a lot of different ways. So it's a struggle, but I do think that we are developing new approaches and methodologies that certainly improve our ability to understand these things in rodent models that we can then test to some degree in the human clinic.
So let's talk more about the experiments. How do you experimentally manipulate the epigenetic changes?
Sure. Yeah, so it can be done in a variety of different ways. I think the classical way of doing this is to basically manipulate the enzymes that put on or take off these modifications. So you can overexpress them, knock them down, mutate them, however you may do it. That can be done both in cells and also in animals. There are drugs for a lot of these proteins, pharmacological inhibitors, some activators for these different types of proteins. You can also manipulate the proteins that read these modifications or bind to them, or the complexes that regulate them. So that's one way. I think a kind of a newer, very exciting way is the ability to use CRISPR-Cas9 technology to basically target these epigenetic modifiers to very specific loci or genes of interest to show causally that you can regulate the marks and the actual transcription of those genes. And there are other chemical methodologies, I won't belabor, that we're starting to use that allow us to actually de novo generate these modifications, even within the brain in a very cell type specific way. So that's super exciting. So be on the lookout for that. We've got a lot of ideas about how we can basically assess causality, because that's always been the problem, right? Is that, you know, we see these marks change in the brain, for example, in response to a stimulus. We can manipulate the enzyme and say, oh, you know, this is what it's doing. But always keep in mind that enzymes that acetylate histones also acetylate many other proteins, right? So you have to be very careful about how you draw connections. But we are getting closer to being able to directly put on and take off these marks. And that, I think, will help to elucidate their mechanisms more broadly.
Mm. So you would want to directly put on and remove those marks because, say, pharmacologically inhibiting the enzymes that do that, would that produce a global decrease in?
Exactly. So, you know, from a clinical standpoint, maybe it isn't so bad, right? If you find something that inhibits an acetyltransferase and it doesn't have a lot of off-target phenotypic effects and it cures depression, then sure, why not use it? But I think from a biology standpoint, we don't know what that's actually doing. Right? You know, just like we don't really know what SSRIs are doing. If you give a HDAC inhibitor or a HAT inhibitor, it could inhibit acetylation or promote acetylation on histones, but it may also promote acetylation or inhibit it on thousands of other proteins. And so it makes it very challenging to then pinpoint and target specific processes that may then, you know, lead to less side effects.
Mm. Right. And so how could you get specific change? Like, how could you directly specifically change the epigenetic marks?
Well, so again, I think that, you know, it in cells and in preclinical models, you know, we have tools. So for example, let's say you want to put on just one histone modification at one gene of interest, right? You can express viruses that express Cas9 that will then, with guide RNAs, direct it to a gene of interest and fuse to that Cas9. You can have a domain of an enzyme that puts on a modification. So you can actually then target just to put on that mark at one place. Another way to do it is using, and this is what we're doing in our lab in collaboration with some fantastic chemists at Princeton and Sloan Kettering, is using entine methodologies to basically de novo generate these marks. So this is an approach where we can express histones that have truncated histone tails, and they have these fragments that are called entines, right? So this is a self-splicing protein intron that's found in yeast. When it's delivered to a certain region or incorporates into chromatin, you then can deliver the other fragment of the entine, right? Which this is a process where they basically splice together, but connected to that entine is actually the tail that you've modified in vitro. So you can put on a modified tail in a very specific cell population within the brain and then test to see directly if, in the absence of manipulating any of the other factors, if I just put on this mark in this cell, what is it doing to transcription and what is it doing to the phenotypes? Mm.
That's super cool.
It'd be great if we could then make that more of a druggable type of solution down the line. And actually, this is not our work, but you know, in the entine field, they've now been expressing Cas9 with one entine fragment and then delivering small molecule inhibitors with the other entine fragment. So you can drug a very specific gene locus. And I think that holds a lot of promise for the future of kind of targeted therapeutics.
Mm. Right. So let's talk about clinically, what implications do these findings have on clinical diagnosis or treatment of mental disorders?
Yeah, so I think, it comes in kind of two varieties from my perspective. I mean, one is, we want to understand the basic mechanisms so that we can figure out what puts on these marks, takes them off, reads them, what the outcome is transcriptionally and phenotypically, because then we can start to develop perhaps pharmacotherapeutics that can target those types of interactions and ultimately perhaps reverse some of these aberrant phenotypes that we see where maybe you have too much of these marks, you need to be able to bring them down. That would be one approach. The other is from a diagnostic perspective. We've actually found, for example, in my lab, and we've received some funding from OneMind for this type of work, where we found that some of the changes occurring on these monomethylation marks within the brain are mimicked within the periphery, within the blood. And so one thought we've had and that we're working toward is what if you could take blood draws from individuals that have a certain disorder, like major depressive disorder? What if you could then take continual blood draws as they start to take drugs that help that aim to alleviate their symptoms? As we know in depression, some drugs will alleviate symptoms better than others, depending on the individual. Wouldn't it be great if we could actually look at how the serotonin mark is responding in the blood by treatments and then use that to predict whether they're on the right regimen of a pharmacotherapeutic or not? And so, this would be, I think this is also not just with serotonin, but people are interested in this and other epigenetic mechanisms, seeing whether we can use this information as a diagnostic or have to see if it has predictive value in treatment responses.
Yeah, that's so cool. On the treatment bit, do you think that that globally changing the like amount of these epigenetic markers will be able to restore the healthy phenotype, or would we need to have specific targeted interventions that can change them specifically?
I mean, this is again another million-dollar question. I think that there are probably certain disorders and disease states where kind of globally altering these marks is going to be important. I think particularly for cancer and certain immunological disorders, this has proven true. We have a paper about to be published in Nature Communications where we're looking at this in the context of schizophrenia. We're using kind of bulk inhibitory responses, and we see alleviation of a lot of aberrant transcriptional plasticity. Having said that, I do think there are going to be disorders where it's going to be very locus specific, and you can actually produce more problems, perhaps by causing global shifts, right? If you only have too much serotonin at two or five genes, right? If you globally inhibit it, this could be a major problem. And so this is something we, of course, have to tease apart.
Okay, so let's move on to like some personal bits for this last bit of the
Sure.
podcast. How did you get interested in science and in particular your research area?
Yeah, so I mean, I think I've been interested in science, from a pretty young age. I grew up, both of my parents were anthropologists, so I had some exposure to academia and scientific research, very different type of scientific research, but scientific research nonetheless. And I, as an undergrad, was very interested, particularly in substance use disorders, again, stemming, I think, from some of my parents' research work in the field. So I started working in a honeybee neurophysiology lab, a neuroethology lab, where we were trying to see if we could get honeybees to self-administer ethanol and then monitor their behavior and look at other physiological effects. So I really caught the bug there. I thought it was super interesting. I ended up moving to UCSF, San Francisco, where I worked in a Drosophila genetics lab. Ulrike Haebelein was my PI. And then I moved to Texas, where I met Eric Nessler, who was my PhD advisor and is now the Dean of Academic Sciences at Mount Sinai. And it was there that I really kind of, found my love for neuroepigenetics research. He was one of the kind of pioneers in neuroepigenetics research. So caught the bug there. And then I did a postdoc with David Alice at Rockefeller, who is kind of like the preeminent scientist in histone biochemistry in the world. And so through all of that, it's been a really exciting path, and I've gotten to see both sides of that coin, really kind of hardcore molecular neurobiology, behavioral neurobiology, but also chromatin biochemistry. And so the goal of my lab is to really kind of blend the two of those together.
Oh, wow. What was it like working with Eric Nestler, and what did you learn from him?
I mean, Eric is phenomenal. Anyone who knows Eric knows that he is a boss that is second to none. So he, like, as I mentioned, he was my obviously PhD advisor, and we were very close in that respect. And as a dean, he's also absolutely outstanding. What did I learn from Eric? I think I learned from Eric how to think big. I think one of the things that happens often when you're an undergrad, even if you've done a lot of research, is that you become so overly focused on the minutia of what you're doing that sometimes you lose sight of the big picture. And I think that, you know, working with Eric, you know, really taught me to think big, to think outside of myself, and to really learn how to carve my own niche. And I think that it was actually working with him that led me to David Alice, which was really a switch of fields. You know, it was still epigenetics, but a very different approach to epigenetics. But it gave me the courage to do that. And then, of course, you know, the amount that I learned in David's lab, you know, I can't even begin to express how much I learned there that has really shaped what we do. But yeah, I think thinking big, and maybe the other thing I'll mention is writing. Writing is so important in science, as I'm sure you and everyone in this field knows. Can't be underestimated. And I learned how to write scientifically from Eric, and that has helped me a lot.
Mm. What is your favorite part about doing science?
Oh, that's great. You know, honestly, it's the people that work for me. You know, you never really learn how to manage a group when you're doing, you know, a PhD or a postdoc. You're kind of thrust into it and you have to just figure it out on the fly. And I have to say that, you know, my group members past and present and even the future ones that are coming, you know, it's really exciting to see them grow and succeed. And, you know, my people have done very well. And, you know, I don't know, they feel like a family. And I think that's probably been the most exciting thing. And also, you know, when I started my lab, I had all my ideas, but to be able to now have an entire group of people to share ideas, to hear their ideas, and you know, we move into all kinds of directions that I never would have imagined. So it keeps it really, really exciting.
Mm, yeah, that's great. What are some of the problems you are currently working on, and what do you hope to tackle in the future?
Yeah, so I mean, one of the big things we're working on, not surprisingly, is trying to really get more granular in terms of understanding these modification states, both on histones and other proteins, at a single cell or at least cell population specific level. So this is, you know, obviously the field is moving in that direction. We too are moving in that direction, trying to understand where, in which cell types these things exist, you know, how they're regulated different cell types, how does that affect the trajectory of those cell types? So that's one certainly big area. The other is that, you know, we have a whole other side of the lab that we didn't get to talk about today, which is, you know, really understanding how mutations in these or aberrant regulation of these different epigenetic states regulate kind of neurodevelopmental processes and cognitive inflexibility later on in life and so forth. And so this is something that we're really moving toward. Obviously, mechanistically, we have a long way to go. You know, we just discovered these things and have published a few papers on them, but we have a long way to go to really understand their full breadth. And then finally, I'll just say that, you know, without going into too much detail, because I don't want to, you know, take away from all the people in my lab doing their amazing work, but, you know, some of these areas that I never expected to be in, I mentioned the pregnancy study, these areas are just super exciting to me. So not just looking at disease-associated epigenetic plasticity, but really like how just normal experience causes changes in trajectories that can persist forever. And so for me, that's super exciting. And I think that'll keep us occupied for quite a while.
Mm. One last question. What advice do you have for young scientists?
Well, I think, you know, I mean, one is to try to enjoy what you're doing. I think it's very easy to get caught up in, you know, just working all the time and kind of, you know, throwing yourself into it. I think it's important to have perspective. I think it's important to, you know, also reevaluate what you're doing in terms of, you know, reading the literature, understanding the context, again, not becoming too myopically focused on smaller things. So being able to think big. But in terms of just a real piece of advice, I think, you know, forming collaborations, this is really important. Relationships are very important in science. This is important all the way from, you know, getting collaborators on board to help you with work as you move forward in your career to, you know, having people help you with grant reviews and so on and so forth. And so I think that, you know, building collaborations from the time you're an early PhD student through your postdoc, being able to take those collaborations with you into the future. This is really important. And again, it also makes science exciting. I am lucky to work with some of the most brilliant people in the epigenetics field, people like Tom Muir and Bob Rader and Ben Garcia. And I mean, I could just name them on and on and on. And the reality is that has helped to shape my career. And I think that's important for everyone to keep in mind.
Ian, this was really interesting. Thanks so much for joining us today and good luck with your research.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.